if you can't get to 75% public majority support, where you show in public that you are ready to stand up to what are going to be very severe blows coming at you from a union busting campaign, you have to say to the workers, there isn't a path to victory. There just isn't a path to victory in this campaign. Yeah.
There are lots of things that we should do differently, but one of them is 700 people at Amazon Bessemer voted for the union. That's a nice nucleus for a minority union. That's what we ought to do.
What the IAM would like to see in a perfect world is a true cooperation between labor and management when it comes to workplace safety.
We have nothing to say about how our tax dollars are spent and have no representation in the U.S. Senate or on the floor of the Congress. So today they're voting on whether to make D.C. a state, but the representatives from D.C. don't even have a say.
One of the counselors told me, look, your English is very bad. Your age is already old. Better dedicate yourself to your family. Get to work. I think school is not for you.
This job goes from 0 to 100 in milliseconds. It could be nothing going on in the city, just quiet as possible, and then that board will blow up and you'll have just everybody screaming for help.
As far as we're concerned, the National Stone, Sand, and Gravel Association, the first place we need to focus is on that traditional infrastructure. That's the most crucial piece.
From the country that brought us Volvo automobiles, IKEA, and 70s pop sensation ABBA comes a revolutionary new technology that is about to turn the construction industry inside out and upside down.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, a roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, longtime organizer Jane McAlevey on what happened at Amazon and how to defeat the union busters. Minority Unionism with Susan Sherman, professor at Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations. Machinist Safety and Health Project Coordinator Sean Trude on how the union is fighting for more protections amid COVID-19. Metro Washington Council Political Director David Stephen reports on the latest efforts to enfranchise 700,000 American workers and voters in the District of Columbia. When we think about college, there's a certain whimsical image, a time of self-discovery and carefree fun before you step out into the real world. But now with the rising cost of education and living expenses, most students work and work a lot. Adolfo Gonzalez shares his decades-long journey to provide for his family while pursuing his education. The 7th Street Chronicles, the brand new podcast from Charlotte Firefighters Association Local 660, celebrates National Public Safety Telecommunicator Week by recognizing the critical role dispatchers play in answering emergency calls. National Stone, Sand, and Gravel Association President and CEO Michael Johnson talks about how an infrastructure plan will prioritize surface transportation and how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected travel. Plus, is the American construction industry ready for self-driving screws and self-hammering nails? We've got reports today from the Heartland Labor Forum, Monday Morning QB, Activate Live, Your Rights at Work, Rework Radio, the 7th Street Chronicles, America's Workforce Radio, and Grit Northwest. I'm Chris Garlock for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. On tonight's show, we spend the show with longtime successful organizer Jane McAlevey. We ask her what happened at Amazon, how to defeat the union busters, and what's the first step a worker here in Kansas City should take if they're fed up and want a union where they work. McAlevey says, I've spent my life teaching workers how to win.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel.
Jane McAlevey
is, above all else, a union organizer. Her first book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement, is a memoir of her leadership in organizing drives from New England to Nevada. Her second is a how-to on organizing called No Shortcuts. I use both books in my union leadership classes at UMKC, and students really love them. Jane's third book is called The Collective Bargain, Unions Organizing in the Fight for Democracy. Welcome to the show, Jane, and thanks for being here.
It is so great to be here again, Judy. Nice to be on your show.
Yes, and this is not the first time, so thanks again. So let's start with Amazon. When I heard it announced that you'd be on Democracy Now! Monday morning, I said, I can predict what she's going to say about the defeated Amazon because I've read her books. I wasn't far off. Here's my question. I know it's a lot easier to second guess people's decisions, but what do you think Stuart Applebaum, the president of RWDSU, should have done when he realized that his local in Bessemer had seriously underestimated the number of workers in the Bessemer Fulfillment Center when they filed with way too few signatures last November?
You know, this is obviously a hard topic to talk about because I wish I hadn't written the article because I wish the workers had won. The truth is I have faced situations similar to the one that the RWDSU was facing in Bessemer, meaning where we realized our numbers were very off or workers were flipping their cards against us, or, you know, when you're heading into what's called the it's a labor board hearing. It's a very Byzantine technical legal process. But heading into a labor board election, and sometimes even after, although the law's been changed now, so this is gonna be like, trying to explain labor law to people on a radio program would take like 50 hours. But anyway, suffice to say, what I believe that the union should have done at that point, if they couldn't achieve 75% of all the workers on the authorization card. And by the way, in addition to that, similarly, having them co-sign something that we use in hard campaigns, which is a petition that says on it, it's very important, I'm gonna vote yes for the union, but this petition is not gonna be shown in public unless and until a majority of my coworkers sign it. So when I'm running a hard campaign against an A-level union buster, I take that approach. That we say to the workers up front, if you can't get to 75% public majority support, where you show in public that you are ready to stand up to what are going to be very severe blows coming at you from a union busting campaign, you have to say to the workers, there isn't a path to victory. There just isn't a path to victory in this campaign. Yeah. So let's withdraw the petition. Let's rebuild, try and get more public support, you know, inside of the Amazon facility. And come back and live for another day. I mean, the primary, these are very hard conversations, and I've had them, where you have to say to a worker committee, and the worker committee will usually say, no, we can do it. We can do it, because they haven't yet lived through the kind of campaign that Amazon was obviously going to run. They hired Morgan Lewis. They hired one of the top union busting firms in the country. Jeff Bezos is himself a top union buster. The whole operation is set up to bust unions. We know this. So that's the hard conversation that I think had to happen in Bessemer in December with the workers, which I've had, and they're hard to do. Right. You know, you have to say to people, you have to treat workers like grownups. You have to over and over explain what it's gonna take to be a top union buster. You have to point out that the evidence isn't there, that we can yet beat the top union buster. And then you have to withdraw the petition and live to fight stronger and differently a different day. Maybe you have to go to a different plant at that point and say to the folks, we're gonna keep working, we're gonna stay here. You know, you don't leave Bessemer, you just say, you have to get majority support, and it has to be public in order to stand the blows that are coming in a campaign like this.
I know there's no shortage of people who are wishful thinkers in the labor movement. I mean, that's what sustains us, for heaven's sakes. But unfortunately, it could be a fault too, I think.
I want to ask you, Jane, if you can give some advice to people who are fed up at work and want to organize a union. What advice do you have on what they should do first, and how would you choose a union?
Yeah, you know, they should start to have conversations with their coworkers carefully, meaning quietly.
Carefully, emphasize carefully.
Yeah, carefully and quietly. They should start to invite people to their house, you know, to a cafe. Hey, after shift, you know, let's pick a restaurant or a coffee shop. In the Einstein case, we were meeting in the basement of a restaurant, so that we were not seen in public, but it was the basement where they would have like a dining hall, you know what I mean, next to the hospital. So we wanted to pick a meeting place that's close, you know, close and convenient, so that already very busy workers can easily get to a meeting. But that's away from the facility, and start to have conversations about what are the things that people want to change. You know, the question I ask every worker my entire life is, if you could change three things at work tomorrow, what would they be? So you start to gather up the issues, because the issues really matter. You know, you can't assume what the issues are. They're different for every worker. For some worker, you know, if they're older, they care about their retirement plan. If they're younger, they care about the healthcare plan. And do they have dependent coverage because they plan to have kids, right? I mean, workers have a whole ton of issues that they care about, and you have to ask each one to know what they are. So you need to start to get together, start to figure out the issues. And then, you know, part of what I teach when I'm in a campaign, and even when I'm just teaching classes on how to win, is that you have to then try and get a list of all the workers. Like, take a picture of the schedule, you know, think creatively about how you can get a list of the workers in your workplace, and then actually look at the list and start trying to figure out which one of you knows someone who knows all of the workers in the facility, and start trying to figure out how to move conversations with those workers based on workers who have a relationship to those workers. And once you get to some kind of critical mass, like, you know, if you've got a spread of people, it's really important to do it across departments and across shifts. So the reason to look at a list, the reason to build a list, we call it building your list. The reason that you want to build a list of all the workers is to get a sense of how many there are, how many you're going to have to get, you know, to know that you can win. And you want to really approach it department by department, building it for workers to build what we call, to self-organize and to build a workers committee. You want to make sure you've got representation in every unit, across every type of worker and across every shift. And you want to build a team who's going to start to do that work to reach out into every single part of the facility. But at that point, I think, given the track record of union busters in this country, I think that you want to then start figuring out, all right, let's do some homework and try and figure out how we can get a union in, like how we can get some support from a union. Because if you're in a kind of facility where they're going to hire a union buster, and as you're saying, it's, you know, it can be a local nonprofit versus Amazon. The truth is, you know, one, I don't care, photo, you know, go to the library and photocopy every page in my book. I don't write these books to make money, that's for damn sure. So it's like, but read up on it, do a study group. I mean, what a lot of the teachers tell me is that they, in their case, a lot of them have unions to try and figure out how to win a better contract, right? Or how to make conditions much better. You know, start a study group and have a group discussion, you know, with some union literature about what it takes to win. And then what I recommend in the book is you do want to be thoughtful about how you choose the union that you're going to reach out to. And I recommend a couple of things. One, you want to talk to other workers who are represented by that union. In the case of the Einstein campaign, it actually began in Philadelphia that I talk about in the book. I start that chapter by talking about how it all began, which was one worker at Hahnemann, a different hospital in Philadelphia. They had a horrible incident. You can imagine what that was on the night shift. Something very bad happened because of short staffing in the analysis of the nurses. Horrible incident. And the nurses were freaking out because they knew it was a preventable accident. And they, at 4 a.m, rang up a unionized hospital that they knew had a union in the city of Philadelphia, which was Temple University. They went to the switchboard and they just said, we want to talk to someone in the emergency department. They got to the emergency department. They said, we're at Hahnemann in the emergency department. We want to talk to someone. And they literally described to the person, they said, you have a union, right? I mean, this is a real conversation. They said, you have a union, right? And the nurse at Temple said, yeah, we have a union and it's a great union. And the worker on the phone described what had happened on the shift and said to the nurse in the unionized hospital, would that situation ever happen in your hospital? And when the nurse said no, the organizing campaign was off and running. And the next thing that happened was the nurse at the unionized hospital said, I'd be happy to meet with a few of you in the next few days. Let's talk about it. They met. She went and got staff from her union and said, let's go. Let's start because there's some really big issues. So do homework like that. If there isn't a union in your area, which unfortunately may be the case right now in America, then I recommend that if you call up the union that represents a lot of workers in your industry, we call it the industry still, you know, look for a union that has other workers like the ones that you're trying to represent. And you call up the union and say, we're interested in forming a union. You want to say to the union, I'd like to talk to some, not just the staff. The first thing we'd like to request from you is that you put us directly in touch with at least several different workers from several of your facilities who have the union, because we'd like to talk to them. And talk to them and actually hear what the workers have to say. And if a union says to you, no, or we can't put you in touch with people or something, call another one.
Thank you very much, Jane McAlevey.
My pleasure, Judy Ansel.
The book is A Collective Bargain, Unions Organizing in the Fight for Democracy. Boy, that's a long title.
You get
it from HarperCollins. And I would say that whether you're a union leader Whether you're a rank and filer or whether you don't have a union, you'll get something from this book. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
This is Monday Morning QB, April 19th, 2021. I'm Askia Muhammad. Results in an historic union vote were released earlier this month, and they don't look too good for organized labor. Workers at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, voted against forming a union roughly 38% to 62%. Activists have accused the company of intimidation, and the union plans to file charges with the National Labor Relations Board. But what's next for the workers themselves? Reporter Chris Banker-Drowns has more.
In a typical union election, a majority of workers must vote for the union for it to have exclusive bargaining authority in the workplace. Without a majority vote, a company is under no legal obligation to bargain with workers collectively. But some scholars and activists want to reimagine what it means to organize on the job, suggesting what's called a minority union. In other words, a union with less than a majority of workers.
Even without the ability to bargain collectively for everybody, a minority union has the ability to aggregate, if you will, members that want to be part of a union and that want union representation.
That's Susan Sherman, distinguished professor and former dean at the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations. This minority union strategy is rare, but has been used before when a union election falls short of winning a majority. Take the example of the 2014 auto workers election in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
What happened was, after the UAW lost the election, and lost it narrowly, and then lost it because there was so much pressure from the conservative political apparatus in Tennessee, the union then met with the company and created a minority union, and then together they set up a works council.
That works council, with representation from workers and the company, helped set standards at the auto plant. Volkswagen, given its familiarity with works councils in Europe, may be more amenable to such an arrangement than more stringently anti-union companies like Amazon. And without a willing management, bargaining through a minority union could prove difficult. Existing labor law suggests that employers are only legally obligated to bargain with majority unions.
It's unclear in the private sector whether such a union has, in fact, legal collective bargaining rights. That has, frankly, not been tested. And I'm hoping that it will be tested under the Biden administration when the labor board is hopefully reconstituted slightly so that it's less tilted against unions.
That process of testing minority union bargaining authority could start with a labor board ruling, which would then likely be appealed to the courts. But even without this legal guarantee of bargaining authority, minority unions have some teeth.
Some of them have demonstrated quite clearly that they can gain benefits for members and frankly for non-members by using the concerted activity clause of the National Labor Relations Act, which allows workers, as long as there's two of you or more, to engage in concerted activity to improve the terms and conditions of your work.
This concerted activity protection is a core right for workers and serves as a buffer against the kind of anti-union campaign Amazon ran at its Bessemer plant. Without stricter protections through the PRO Act, and without the due process afforded by a union contract, minority unions do face difficult prospects. But organizing in the workplace has always been difficult, And Susan Sherman says we need to shift our approach.
We can continue forever running campaigns where we lose because the deck is stacked so heavily against us. Or we can go in and set up an organization and start acting like a union. And let's do, you know, if we get majority status, then the free rider problem goes away. They have to join and pay dues. And if it's a right to work state, we have that problem now anyway.
So as always, organizing is the answer. The loss in Bessemer just means new organizing strategies are needed.
There's an old expression that says, if you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got. We've been trying to do the old way of organizing since the 80s, and we're at 6.3% density in the private sector. We got to do something different. There are lots of things that we should do differently, but one of them is 700 people at Amazon Bessemer voted for the union. That's a nice nucleus for a minority union. That's what we ought to do.
That's Susan Sherman, distinguished professor and former dean at the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns.
Absolutely it is. It doesn't always have to be as adversarial as people want to think that it is when a union gets involved.
Coming up, safety on the job is more important now perhaps than ever. We'll discuss what's working, what's not, and what we'd like to see in an ideal situation. Activate Live starts now.
Speak up, speak out, get involved, get involved.
Engage-toi.
Take action.
Aktiviere deine Stimme.
We're union and we're proud.
Welcome to Activate Live. I'm Tanya Hutchins with the Machinist Union. Well, our motto is justice on the job, service to the community. As union members, we want to have a voice on the job and respect, but we also want safety. Joining us now to discuss workplace safety and health amid COVID-19 is IAM Project Coordinator Sean Trude. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me today, Tanya.
So what helps us as workers to feel safe? What needs to be done?
For workers to feel safe, they need to have education. They need to be informed about what they're potentially exposed to and what they can do to safeguard themselves from those exposures. This obviously isn't just true of the current COVID-19 situation, but workplace safety in general. You have to know what you are going to be around and how you can protect yourself to feel safe in doing your job.
So what should workplaces be doing? Because I know a lot of workplaces are going through different changes on their sites, in the shops. What should they be doing?
OSHA had issued some guidance last month about preparing workplaces in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And by now, all employers really should have developed and implemented an infectious disease disaster preparedness plan that's going to look at dealing with employee absenteeism or declines in business. They should be maintaining an infectious disease prevention plan, including things like encouraging frequent hand washing for your employees, maintaining regular housekeeping that includes cleaning and disinfecting, especially if frequently touched surfaces. They should be trying to minimize employees sharing things like phones, keyboards, office spaces, and tools as much as possible. They should also be encouraging employees to stay home if they're sick. Paid sick leave is something that most of our members have and are able to take. But these are just some of the steps that they should be taking. They should also be requiring, as the CDC has now recommended that everybody wears a face covering, that just not extend not only to the employees, but any contractors that may be coming on site. Everybody should be having a face covering on when they're out in public, especially when they're unable to maintain proper social distancing.
So what does the ideal safe workplace look like? Like, what would the IAM like to see in a perfect world?
So what the IAM would like to see in a perfect world is a true cooperation between labor and management when it comes to workplace safety. IAM Crest, we setting up committees, joint committees between labor and management. But we want there to be equal buy-in from both parties in performing the worksite assessments, addressing safety concerns as they come up aggressively, not just taking a position that it's going to be too costly to implement that change, because labor and management, we're all working in the same building. I get that management spends a lot more time in the office in some locations than out on the floor, but if it's in the air, it's in the air. So we all need to work together to make sure that we're all going home as good as we came in the morning.
You know, and I have visited workplaces where, you know, the HR person and either, you know, the IAM business rep or shop steward, they are working hand in hand. So I think it's important to remind people that it is possible to have a good relationship, especially about safety.
Absolutely it is. It doesn't always have to be as adversarial as people want to think that it is when a union gets involved.
We have a comment from Kim Webb Bingham saying all IAM members need to share this with all your brothers and sisters. Thank you so much for commenting, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
Adriana Picasso Lehigh is saying transportation has lost many lives due to COVID-19. As essential workers, we are doing what we can to stay safe. So thank you for all the info. And Dave Roderick is saying, great show. You answered some of my questions. Thanks, Sean.
Well, thank you.
We're so glad that you took the time to answer a lot of our questions about safety and health. And yeah, keep in touch. Let us know if there's anything else that you want us to be aware of, Sean.
All right. Thank you very much, Tanya.
Welcome to Your Rights at Work. Chris Garlock here with Ed Smith. Happy Earth Day, brother.
Happy birthday.
Earth Day, not birthday, dude.
Oh, Earth Day. I was like, it's not my birthday, but I'll celebrate anyway. Happy Earth Day to you, my brother, on this chilly day here in D.C.
My favorite headline I saw on this was from Jacobin. It said, to save the planet, expropriate the rich.
I like that. Yeah.
I thought you would. Hey, we got a great show lined up, folks. As always, you can join us 202-588-0893. If you got questions about your rights, the ones you have, the ones you don't have, the ones you wish you had, this is the place to let us know. 202-588-0893. Historic vote in the House. We are going to have a report from the field on that. Also, there is a strike going on. You wouldn't really know it. A lot of attention being paid to it, but we're going to report on that. And also a little bit later, constructing a new social compact. There's a public forum coming up next week on empowering the post-pandemic working class. Say that three times fast. But first, the House just had a vote on D.C. statehood. And to tell us more about that historic step, we got a D.C. resident, our political director at the Metro Washington Council, my good friend and colleague, David Stephen. Brother, how you doing today?
Doing great. What's up, Chris? What's up, Ed?
Hey, David. Nice to see a fellow D.C. resident. I'm sure the vote was unanimous because it makes perfect sense that D.C. is the state.
You would think that all these lawmakers that probably spend more time here in D.C. than they do in their own home states would agree with us. Unfortunately, it's a nasty political divide as usual. So welcome to modern day politics, right? I was telling someone that today was the second time that D.C. statehood went in front of the House floor in the U.S. Congress, because it went before the House in the last term. But this is the first time it goes to a Democratic-led Senate. So that's a very big difference that we have now. And as much as I hate to say it, it seems that right now we live in a world and in a country where Democrats are about expanding voting rights and Republicans are about shrinking. And that's a sad reality, because the voting, which is the cornerstone of our democracy, should be a bipartisan effort that everyone can agree about. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen here. And we know here in DC that more than 700,000 residents in the District of Columbia are denied representation. We're taxed. We have nothing to say about how our tax dollars are spent, and have no representation in the U.S. Senate or on the floor of the Congress. So today they're voting on whether to make D.C. a state, but the representatives from D.C. don't even have a say so in that. So that's where we are, unfortunately. I think that we are standing at a point in history where we can move forward or we can move backward. I think that for the last 4 years, unfortunately, we've been exposed to how bad things could be. And the fact that a lot of the attitudes and a lot of the sentiments that we thought were remnants of the 60s really hadn't gone away. They just hadn't had an opportunity to prosper, and they did prosper under the last administration. So now we've got to fight that back, and we have to fight it back in a much more blatant way. And we're seeing all these voter suppression laws that are being passed and legislated all over the country, and they're all based on what we call the big lie, right? This idea that the election was somehow stolen, which is nothing more than code for if minorities have a say-so and how our government is actually run, then that means that it was stolen from us, the white majority. And that represents the worst of what we are. And we have to make sure that we move that in a different direction. I refuse to believe that the vast majority of Americans want to see this country move backward, want to see rights rolled back for anyone. But we've just got to keep up the fight, because we have a vocal minority that does want to see that happen. And they're not giving up, and neither should we.
David Stephen, political director at the Metro Council.
I want a hippie to a travesty, cause there's a blot on our democracy when the good people of D.C. keep paying for a house where they can't get a seat. It's a real-time tragedy, a hard knock on our democracy when the good people of D.C. keep sending money to a Senate where they can't buy a seat. Taxation without representation, news 250 years old and still breaking, cause D.C. has no congressman
to represent the people.
D.C. has no senator
to represent the people.
When all they really want is to represent the people. So enough shame for politics.
Represent the people.
And what's it gonna take for D.C. to represent?
People making noise.
And politicians making sense.
Shouldn't matter which side you're on. No, you just gotta know right from wrong.
No more lip service to democracy. Give D.C. the vote immediately. It shouldn't matter which side you're on. No, you just gotta know right from wrong. No more lip service to democracy. Give D.C. the vote immediately. Yeah.
From the UCLA Labor Center, we bring you Rework. I'm Saba Wahid.
And I'm Veena Humpapour. When we think about college, there's a certain whimsical image, a time of self-discovery and carefree fun, before you step out into the real world.
But now, with the rising cost of education and living expenses, most students work, and work a lot. And the college base is diverse, consisting of older students, parents, DACA recipients, formerly incarcerated people, foster youth, returning students.
The educational path is complex and often filled with challenges in a system that isn't made for them. In this episode of Rework, Adolfo Gonzalez shares his decades-long journey to provide for his family while pursuing his education.
Adolfo was born into an indigenous family speaking Zapotec in Oaxaca, Mexico. He was educated in an elite boarding school, but by 1986, tired of corruption in Mexico and affected by family tragedy, he paid a coyote to take him to San Diego. In the U.S., he started picking tomatoes, later worked as a driver, married, and had two kids. We pick up his story when Adolfo is in his 50s.
After a few years, the itch to learn came back, and Adolfo made an appointment with a college counselor.
I told them that I had already attended the school and that I had intentions to return. And one of the counselors told me, "Look, your English is very bad. Your age is already old. Do you think you can compete with young people? Better dedicate yourself to your family. Get to work. I think school is not for you." For 3 years, it hit me hard. I said, "Yes, she has a point."
So Adolfo didn't go back to school, but he continued to support his family's education. Pretty soon, his wife was settled into a career, his eldest daughter was getting close to her college graduation, and their youngest was in high school. The dream had come true through his family.
They told me, "Now it's your turn." I told them no, that it was too late for me.
Adolfo was still thinking about what the counselor had said when he had tried to enroll the last time.
Me dice, "Mija, no es posible, dice, que una
que una persona te desanime tanto.
My daughter told me no. It's not possible that a person discourages you so much. Go back to school. This time, I met Dr. Aaron, a counselor who helped me a lot. This man said, you have talent, you have the intelligence, you have everything, and I'm going to help you. I told him what had happened, and he said, fortunately, this person no longer works with us. I did not enroll in school to prove to someone. I did it because it was a desire that I had to get an education for years.
Adolfo enrolled in school. Now he had to figure out what to do with his income and work schedule.
I quit my job as a driver, and I looked for a job in a car wash where I could work Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. It was one of the biggest sacrifices I made by working days that are for the family. They taught me how to treat cars with different chemicals, how to make a complete detail. I said, if I manage to do a car or two per week, apart from my work on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, I could use this money to continue helping my mother.
For the next 2 years, Adolfo studied hard. He took math, history, Chicano studies, and all the general ed requirements.
Muchacho, un estudiante también de allí, Brian Chávez, un muchacho muy, muy, muy inteligente, que me ayudó y dijo, ¿sabes qué? Dice, vamos a volver a reorganizar el
club. I met a student, Brian Chávez, a very intelligent man who said, you know what? We are going to reorganize the Spanish club. I had the opportunity to be president of the club and work as a Spanish tutor at Hartnell. And I also had the opportunity to work in a middle school after school program. I started to notice that the education was starting to open a path to other types of jobs. It was no longer in a car wash, no longer in the fields. And this is what I tell people, that an education always, always gives large benefits.
A very special thanks to Adolfo Gonzalez for sharing his story. Thank you to Magali Lopez for conducting this interview in Spanish and Leslie Ayala for translating. Also thank you to Jesus Ramirez and Ethel Meyer in Salinas, California for the sound recording at Radio Bilingüe.
You're listening to ReWork, a program of the UCLA Labor Center.
Welcome to the 7th Street Chronicles, a podcast from your Charlotte Firefighters Association, Local 660.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the 7th Street Chronicles. I'm your host again today, Tom Brewer, president of your Charlotte Firefighters Association, Local 660. And it's National Public Safety Telecommunicator Week. And so what better time to introduce everyone to some people in alarm? A lot of people may know some people in alarm. Why don't both of you introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about you?
Okay. My name is Melissa Lounsbury. I am a supervisor in alarm. I originally started with the Charlotte Fire Department in 2008, and I've been a supervisor for just about a year.
John Schuler, I've been with alarm, well, for 3.5 years now. I've been in the fire service for 30, but just pretty new to alarm, but it's an awesome job.
Do you think a lot of people in alarm have fire service background, or is there just a mix? Just, I'm curious because I don't know myself.
I'd say it's a mix. We've got a couple people. I think Kendall and Morgan came from a veterinary background. People come from offices. Michelle came from the airport. She was a dispatcher at the airport, or she dispatched service vehicles at the airport. So we got people from all different, you know, walks of life that come here.
How many, I know, let's take last year out of it, because last year was kind of an anomaly with COVID. On a typical year, how many calls is alarm answering?
There is a number, and I don't know if we can use this as an exact quote or not, but I believe that emergency calls answered was somewhere around 150,000 last year.
Wow.
For alarm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I will lie to you.
That's just 911 calls, though. That's not the rest of the phone calls we take.
Right.
Very cool. So we talk about the stress of firefighting a lot. Why don't you two share with everyone the stress of, you know, being a telecommunicator on top of, I know, normal calls, like, you know, you have to answer the stressful call when that caller's on the other line and they may be emotional. But I also imagine during, whether it's storms or like civil unrest, tell us a little bit about your guys' world in those high stress situations.
This job goes from 0 to 100 in milliseconds. It could be nothing going on in the city, just quiet as possible. And then that board will blow up and you'll have just everybody screaming for help. Storms are incredibly stressful. They are nonstop, 911 phone ringing. You can take a call, get as much information, hang up, and there'll be 50 more calls waiting to go. And that really puts a toll on the telecommunicators mentally, because it's just nonstop. There is no, you don't get a break during that. And if the storm goes on for 3 hours, it's just, you got to do your best. So it definitely puts a stressful toll on their, you know, mental sanity.
Well, and one thing that I don't know if everybody knows, and not all communication centers operate this way, but our task when we sit down and plug in at a console aren't just to answer phones or just to answer the radio. So when we're being hammered with a storm or civil unrest calls, or, you know, we had a tornado last year, we're answering that phone as quick as possible. But we also have assigned operational channels that each one works. So we're simultaneously answering radio traffic, giving pertinent information, you know, perhaps working a working incident, and answering 911 at the same time. So we have to make sure our fire trucks and our citizens are getting all the information that they need at the same time.
So, you know, we talk about the stress, and sometimes the calls do get to you. Now, with that said, does Alarm have access to, like, you know, peer support, or are there outlets or measures that you guys, you know, can take to handle these stressful situations, or the cumulative effect of years of answering these calls and working the schedule as you work?
I mean, we do have access to peer support. I would say, you know, when Chief Starnes presented the peer support program that he put together a couple of years ago, it actually really surprised me how strongly it affected me, because normally Alarm just isn't considered the boots on the street or who do the work, right? You know, the calls that we take that stick with us are just kind of something we've quietly lived with and dealt with amongst ourselves. And just in recent years, has peer support been taking a more active role in when they're going out to a station after an incident, they'll stop by Alarm or call into Alarm also. And it's really important, I think, because we kind of are our own support system. And, you know, if each one of us isn't healthy mentally and emotionally, we're not necessarily the best support system for each other. So getting that outside support really is important for us.
Awesome, you guys. I really appreciate it. That was cool. I think you guys told some really good stuff that I think is going to give a different perspective for people.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Be safe.
Thanks.
Hey, thanks for listening. We hope you tune in to the next episode. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast to stay updated on the next episode. Also, while you're at it, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and make sure you check out our website at www.cffa660.org. Stay strong, stay union.
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
All right, talking more about infrastructure. What goes into infrastructure? Stone, sand, and gravel. No doubt about that. Joining us on line number two right now is Mike Johnson, who's president and CEO of the National Stone, Sand, and Gravel Association, which is based right outside Washington, D.C., where everything happens or sometimes doesn't happen. Hey, Mike Johnson, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us. Well, we hope this one happens, don't you?
We very much hope this happens, and we really need it. It is long overdue. And our economy, while it's coming back from the pandemic, it's just not all the way there. And we can't get there unless we invest in our country in a meaningful way. And the American Jobs Act, with its investment in infrastructure, It is that meaningful way. It's the way that we get back to good jobs and get people working again and get our country moving again. Our infrastructure is our economic circulatory system. You mentioned it. The association I represent provides stone, sand, and gravel for that infrastructure. In fact, there are 38,000 tons of our product of stone, sand, and gravel in every 1 mile of road. It's just essential that we start getting things growing again in this country, and infrastructure investment is the way to do it.
Mike, let me ask you about the supply system in America, the supply chain, to be more specific, because there's a lot of industries that are hurting right now because of lumber, for one. The price of lumber has gone up in new construction. Roofing supplies, I know that's being held up, and a lot of this is pandemic-related, and there's a number of components as to why it's happening, but in your association, sand, stone, and gravel, how are we looking? Are you ready to rock and roll? what's the story?
We are absolutely ready to rock and roll. Our members, over 100,000 men and women across this country working every day to produce the stone, sand, and gravel we need to grow this country, they're ready to go, and we can provide it. Look, the fact of the matter is, you talk about supply chain. Yeah, our congestion today on our roads, our inefficiencies in our transportation network, they add cost to everything, whether it's that lumber you mentioned or whether it's stone, sand, and gravel, or whether it's your Amazon delivery this afternoon. Look, everything is more expensive when our infrastructure is not working the way it should. Delays that have trucks stuck trying to get around an intersection in South Carolina or railroads that are bogged down outside of Chicago, all that adds cost and adds delay into our economy. And those are things that when we're already struggling to get back from the pandemic, we can ill afford.
So where's your association as far as lobbying on this issue? And this jobs bill, American Jobs Plan, is pretty large. There's some concern that it's maybe not all infrastructure. I'd like to get your opinion. And the other part of it's a two-part question. Paying for it. That's the big issue, as you well know. What's your thoughts?
First off, when you talk about infrastructure, anytime you're talking about infrastructure, whether you call it that or not, it is a jobs bill. Just in our industry alone, in the aggregates industry, for every one job that's created in aggregates to meet the need for investment in infrastructure, five more jobs are created in allied industries or in industries that serve the aggregates industry. So you have a multiplier effect when you invest in infrastructure in our industry and in many others. So it is a jobs bill, and it's very important. Now, you raise the issue. A lot of people are debating about whether traditional infrastructure, roads, bridges, runways, waterways, railways, whether that should be the focus or whether the jobs bill has too much focus on what some are calling the care infrastructure. Look, there's no question that in a number of ways in this country, we need to focus on better. And as far as we're concerned, the National Stone, Sand, and Gravel Association, the first place we need to focus is on that traditional infrastructure. That's the most crucial piece. As you think about our economy, you think about making investments that generate economic growth. For every dollar you put into that traditional infrastructure, that hard infrastructure, you get $3 to $4 in GDP growth associated with it. It has a multiplier effect, just like it does with job creation. So we think that's really important. And if Congress needs to take what is a big chunk of legislation that they need to bite off here and break it into smaller pieces, then let's do that. But let's not waste this opportunity to get real significant long-term sustainable investment in infrastructure done.
Mike Johnson, President and CEO of the National Stone, Sand, and Gravel Association. You take care, stay safe, and stay in touch, all right?
You got it. Thank you for the time. It's great being with you.
From the country that brought us Volvo automobiles, IKEA, and 70s pop sensation ABBA comes a revolutionary new technology that is about to turn the construction industry inside out and upside down. Tislub Industries, innovators of self-drive nanotechnology based in Gävle, Sweden, have made a massive impact on Europe's construction industry in recent years with their self-driving screws and self-hammering nails, and they are now preparing to cross the pond in an effort to capture the American market and irreversibly change the face of carpentry. Haven't heard much T-Slub on your job yet? Consider yourself lucky. In Europe, it's everywhere. In fact, you can't walk 3.3 meters without stepping into a conversation full of it. Having recently witnessed the incredible stride in what was once considered impossible, I must say I'm awed, amazed, and somewhat concerned for what this means for our professional tradespeople. So just what is TSLUB? In this special edition of Grit Northwest, we will find out. Hi, I'm Joe Cadwell, writer, producer, and host of the show, and today I will dig deep and dive headfirst into TSLUB in an attempt to uncover the past, present, and future of this game-changing technology and determine for myself whether this space-age advancement can truly upend the commercial construction world. To do so, I will be interviewing the CEO of TSLUB Industries, Stepan TSLUB. Stepan, together with his sisters Lotta and Fula TSLUB, oversee the giant empire of TSLUB that their great-grandfather Jerry founded decades ago. TSLUB Industries combines the cutting-edge science of nanoparticles and revolutionary advances in Bluetooth technology to set construction industry fasteners with greater speed and accuracy, upping production cost on building projects and increasing profits by over 50%. We'll begin our conversation with Stepan by discovering the origins of TSLUB and how the current generation of TSLUB differs from generations past. Next, we'll investigate what TSLUB self-drive technology is and how this tiny bucolic town set in the pastoral landscape of central Sweden has become a leader in this advanced technology. For more TSLUB, be sure to visit the show notes at the end of the episode. And now, on to the show. Stepan TSLUB, welcome to the show.
Tack så mycket, Joe. Det ska bli riktigt roligt att få vara med här. Jag kommer inte ihåg sen jag var så här. Hello and thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thank you, Stepan, for taking your time to be on the show. I know you're calling in from Sweden and that you're here to talk to myself and the listeners and introduce TSLUB Industries. So, Stepan, what is TSLUB and why should we care?
TSLUB is the result of generations of hard work and dedication to better lives of snickare.
Snickers?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think the English word is carpenters. To better the life of the carpenters by allowing them to use more of the time not doing the screwing of screws and the pounding of nails.
But, Stepan, that's what carpenters do.
Yes, indeed. But if they do not have to do these things, they can have much more time for other things, like the sawing of the boards and such.
I see. So how does TSLUB Industries make this happen?
That's a great question, Joe. In a layman's term, TSLUB combines advances with quantum mechanics principles, string theory extractions and atomic layer depositions with level 3 Bluetooth technology. This is then coupled with the Apple products, iOS operating platforms to manipulate assembler molecules embedded into the exterior coatings of the common construction industry cell fasteners to achieve this structural integrity in the building process.
Whew, that's a lot, Stepan. But if I understand you correctly, you're using an app on an iPhone to screw boards together?
Precisely.
Stepan, I call bullshit.
No, it's called TSLUB. Here, see it for yourself.
No way! The screws are screwing themselves into the board. So, Stepan, now that I've witnessed this incredible feat of TSLUB, how does it actually help with productivity and profitability on a job site?
Well, Joe, by purchasing a TSLUB factory production package, contractors can now utilize carpeting time more efficiently. Screws and nails are simply placed on construction surfaces, then activated by a swipe of the fingers. This frees up time to focus in on other tasks, as multiple fasteners can be set at once for simultaneous activation. Additionally, when combined with modulated system upgrades, such as our TSLUB voice command controls, we can even do this hands-free.
Voice-controlled TSLUB?
Precisely. This is the preferred method. No longer will carpenters work tirelessly driving screws or skruvas, som we say in Sweden, with their hands. They only need to place the screws, hold the boards together and yell, skruva, skruva, and the voice recognition software will do the rest.
Wow, that does sound incredible. Thank you again for being on the show. It's been a real pleasure.
Tack så mycket, yo. Hej då.
Our guest today has been Stepan TSLUB from TSLUB Industries. To find more TSLUB, including the incredible video from this interview, be sure to visit the show notes. A full transcript is also available, as well as your opportunity to win TSLUB gear. So don't delay, visit the show notes today.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day a truce came in the Stockton Cannery Workers' Strike. It was a pivotal moment that embodied the conflicts of the 1930s labor movement. The AFL initially wrote agricultural workers off as unorganizable. They soon raced to unionize California canneries ahead of the International Longshoremen's Association's march inland to organize warehouse workers. By early April, Agricultural Workers Union 202-21, representing five canneries, demanded higher pay, better working conditions, and a closed shop. The canners and growers refused on the basis that they had just granted a 25% raise to the workers. They then attempted to spike union support among workers, whether AFL or CIO, by arguing, quote, one was dominated by communists, the other by racketeers, so take your choice. Soon, they formed a Citizens Labor Investigating Committee to thwart the impending strike. Picket lines went up in the early hours of April 15th. Growers and canners appealed to law enforcement to do something and appealed to the public to enlist in the forcible reopening of the canneries. Dubbed the Pick Handle Army, anti-union forces joined the sheriff's department in confronting the strikers on the 23rd. There, they battled with picketers for over 3 hours in what is referred to as the Spinach Riot. Picketers confronted scabs and spinach delivery drivers and were beaten, gassed, and shot by sheriff's forces, resulting in one death and 58 injuries of strikers. Considered one of the worst labor battles in California's history, the State Federation moved to strip the union of its charter once the truce was called. They reorganized workers as Cannery Workers Union 206-76 and won sole recognition. But agricultural workers would remain unorganized for years to come.
That's it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 labor radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon and Chris Banger-Drowns, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net. Find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. This is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio podcast show.